Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Le relais, Jean-Claude Tremblay approuve Richard qui cherche mot de l'œil. La passe est ici, il est seul. Il lance.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
Alors, je voudrais présenter ma collègue du département de philosophie de l'Université de Montréal, Rio Achang, qui aura la responsabilité de gérer le trafic, en quelque sorte, cet après-midi.
Merci beaucoup, Daniel. Merci beaucoup également à Anna pour avoir organisé un tel événement si intéressant. Alors, j'ai le grand plaisir de pouvoir vous présenter les trois conférenciers et les deux commentateurs de ce panel en après-midi. Alors, la session de l'après-midi est consacrée aux perspectives européennes, Perspectives from Europe. On aura l'occasion d'entendre trois conférenciers. Je vais tenter de décrire très brièvement leur long et fascinant parcours. Alors, dans un premier temps, nous aurons l'occasion d'entendre Tariq Madoud, who is a professor in the Sociology Department of Bristol University, UK, and the founding director of the University Research Centre for the Study of Ethnicity and Citizenship at the Bristol Institute for Public Affairs. He is the Bristol Director of the Leverhulme Program on Migration and Citizenship with University College London. With Anna Triandafilidou, he is also leading EMILI, standing for a European Approach to Multicultural Citizenship, Legal, Political, and Educational Challenges with 8 European partners. Madoud is a founding co-editor of the journal Ethnicities. He was made a member of the Order of the British Empire in 2001 and was elected to the Academy of Social Sciences in 2004. Among his numerous publications, the most recent one is edited with G.B. Levy, Secularism, Religion, and Multicultural Citizenship, with a foreword by Charles Taylor, published at Cambridge University Press in 2009. Et dans un deuxième temps, nous aurons l'occasion d'entendre donner une présentation en anglais, mais également avec un résumé en français, notre collègue Éléonore Lépinard, qui est actuellement professeure adjointe au département de sciences politiques à l'Université de Montréal. Ses intérêts de recherche portent sur genre et politique, les mouvements et la théorie féministe, les politiques d'égalité et de lutte contre les discriminations et le multiculturalisme dans une perspective comparée. Elle est l'auteure de « L'égalité introuvable, la parité, les féministes et la République », publié aux presses de Sciences Po à Paris en 2007. Elle est également auteure de deux rapports, dont l'un d'eux est intitulé « Des lois d'exception pour l'islam, religion et discrimination dans les modèles multiculturalistes et républicains, une comparaison France-Canada » pour la Direction à la recherche aux études statistiques et la mission recherche pour le gouvernement français, publié en 2008. En dernier lieu, après la pause, nous aurons l'occasion d'entendre Jean Bobéro, qui est directeur d'études émérites, section des sciences religieuses, titulaire de la chaire d'histoire et sociologie de la laïcité depuis 1991 à l'École pratique des hautes études à Paris. Il a écrit une vingtaine d'ouvrages, dont un roman historique. Il est le co-auteur d'une déclaration internationale sur la laïcité signée par 250 universitaires de 30 pays. Il siégeait à la commission Stasi de réflexion sur l'application du principe de la laïcité mise sur pied par le président Jacques Chirac en 2003. Plus récemment, il a consacré un livre intitulé « Liberté, laïcité, diversité, le Québec, une chance pour la France » sur les débats sur les accommodements raisonnables ici au Québec sous forme de reportage. Et pour écrire ce livre, il a interviewé Gérard Bouchard, Charles Taylor, ainsi que des acteurs importants du débat sur les accommodements raisonnables, dont des citoyens ordinaires. Il a rencontré les leaders municipaux et des citoyens d'Hérouville. Il a assisté à plusieurs forums de la commission Bouchard-Taylor. Et également, pour vous présenter nos commentateurs, alors nous aurons l'occasion d'entendre Manuel Toscano-Mendez qui commentera la présentation de notre collègue Jean Bobéro. et qui est professeur titulaire de philosophie morale et politique au département de philosophie de l'Université de Malaga en Espagne. Il est actuellement chercheur invité au CRIOM, où il travaille sur les arguments normatifs qui s'emploient dans la discussion de la politique linguistique, en particulier en Espagne. Son intérêt sera d'examiner les justifications de ces politiques d'un point de vue libéral. And last but not least, our own beloved colleague and friend Daniel Weinstock, who is also incidentally le directeur du CRIOM. Alors, je vous rappelle la formule. Il y aura donc, dans un premier temps, les deux présentations en anglais, suivies du commentaire de Daniel Weinstock. Nous aurons une pause café et, en dernier lieu, nous aurons la présentation de Jean Bobéro et le commentaire de Manuel Toscano-Mendez.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here and to be part of this discussion. My contribution is going to focus on Chapter 7 of the Bouchard-Taylor Report. That's the chapter on secularism. And my comments are in two parts. The first part is I'd like to raise some questions about the philosophical underpinning of the position presented in that report, in that chapter specifically. And very much I'm just going to ask questions really about the concept of neutrality that is presented there. And then the second part is I want to say something about Britain, you know, given that, if you like, my brief is to present a perspective from somewhere else. How do things seem in Britain on the issues of the report? And it may be that these two parts aren't fully joined up. Well, it's very likely that they're not. And, of course, you know, in terms of time and so on, they're not all fully argued, but very happy to have all discussion about either part or the relationship between the two parts. Okay, then, so beginning with the first part of Chapter 7, the philosophical underpinning for a position of open secularism or neutrality. It's argued there on page 134 that a democratic liberal state can't remain neutral towards certain core norms and commitments and practices. For example, you know, that all citizens are equal in some way, and that these values can be justified by a variety of comprehensive doctrines, to use Rawls's phrase, comprehensive doctrines, so that the justification for those liberal democratic commitments can be a form of overlapping consensus from some higher level ethical, religious, philosophical, metaphysical positions. And I agree with both those, that the liberal state can't be neutral about its core commitments and the possibility of an overlapping consensus. But my question is, does the fact that there can be an overlapping consensus entail that the state has to be an equal distance from each of those justifications, as is argued in the report? For example, take someone like Tariq Ramadan, whose work you may have come across, a European Muslim scholar and public intellectual. He argues that Islam can justify social democracy and secular citizenship, but he doesn't say that the state has to have that justification, or the opposite, that the state doesn't need that justification because it already has some other one, or that it has to be neutral between the various possible justifications. And in fact, his expectation is that the state will have its own justification, but he's offering an extra one, which he thinks will be particularly efficacious, effective, and appropriate in relation to Muslim citizens. But he's not saying that the state must give up if it's already attached to one particular line of justification. It must give up that one just because a Muslim one is possible as well. Well, the Bouchard-Taylor justification for this position about equal distance between all possible justifications comes from what is identified in the report in that chapter as the first principle of the body of principles they want to appeal to, and that is the moral equality of persons. And it said that the state must be able, in principle, to justify to each citizen each of the decisions it makes. And that's, I agree with that, but the text carries on, which it cannot do if it favors a specific conception of the world and of the good. And it's really that second half that I want to question. Why? Why can't it justify to each citizen if it has a favored position? And the position of the report is because all citizens must be able to equally identify with the justification. And so where there are a number of justifications, as in fact is the case in Quebec and in virtually any society we're likely to be interested in, the state, therefore, mustn't identify with any of them. It must be equally neutral or equally distant from all of them. Well, about this position, I have two questions. Well, what about the state favoring a specific language, you know, leaving this kind of justification for democratic principles aside for a moment? What about favoring a specific language or a specific history or interpretation of history or a specific culture? Because it's quite clear, obviously, that the Quebec state not just may, but does favor a language and perhaps not a religion, and it cherishes a particular kind of history or historical narrative, if not a faith. Well, I think the distinction in the report probably would be that favoring a particular kind of justification for liberal democratic principles, you know, from a higher level ethic or religion, is an issue of conscience rather than, say, of identity or heritage. Well, all right, there's something in that distinction. But then why may the state not favor all religions? If it can't favor just one, is it possible that it might favor all of them? After all, the state favors, you know, in some way or another, including in financial ways, but in other ways as well, symbolic ways and so on, the state favors science, art, opera, sport, you know, so many different things. And if the idea of favoring, as it were, all religions, and the term religion is too narrow, well, let's stretch it out. We could say, though, maybe it favors, as it were, by favors, meaning embraces in some way or other or supports in the way that, you know, it supports science or supports sport. It supports all, you know, religion and things like religion. I think the term fundamental convictions is used in the report. Or is it that religion, stroke fundamental convictions, are in some sense a unique category for radical neutrality? Because there are lots of other things the state's not neutral about, and the report doesn't suggest they should be, and neutral, and so on. Because if it's the case that neither a specific religion nor the category of religion stroke fundamental convictions as such can be favored by the state, why is this the case? Because this does seem to me to be quite a, as it were, thick view, meaning that it's not just a political view about equality and democracy and so on, which I agree with the report that the liberal democratic state can't be neutral about, but it seems to me this is more than that kind of view. It's a view about religion, about the nature of religion, about the nature of conscience, and of how we honor the importance of conscience, a view which not all religious people will recognize as a faithful characterization of the significance that their religion has for them. That does not mean that it's wrong, but it seems to be on a par with religious views, not a neutral observation or a principle about religions. So if that is the case, maybe this idea of neutrality is misconceived. So to conclude, the point of those remarks, what I've called my part one, is the view that our fundamental convictions, or what Rawls calls comprehensive doctrines, the view that our fundamental convictions is what religion is about, that it's distinct from religion as identity or heritage or social capital, and that that makes religion uniquely unsuited for identification with the state, well, that really seems to me a fundamental conviction. That is to say, it's a religious point of view. And so if that is not, so if that is the basis for a justification for equality of persons or secularism, it's not neutral. So a view about the kind of importance our fundamental convictions should have is itself a fundamental conviction, and so is not neutral between fundamental convictions. Okay, I change gear here as I enter part two. And I think the first thing I ought to say, to preface the rest of my remarks, is that I am certain that Britain is a secular state. And I say that because some of the other things I might now go on to say might make you think that I doubt that, and I don't. I think Britain is a secular state. Yet it differs in certain ways from what Bouchard Taylor, understand by a secular state, and certainly from what they regard as Quebec's secularism. Of course, they acknowledge that there are different national secularisms, and so do I. So I'll start by offering a brief definition of what I mean by political secularism, and then add some key points about England or Britain, which we have to understand to appreciate the ways in which it is a secular polity. By political secularism, I mean an understanding that political authority and obligations are not the same as religious authority and obligations. The two may be connected, but the former are not based on the latter. There's a relative mutual autonomy between them. So in institutional terms, political secularism is a public space in which religion is not necessarily absent, but in which politics, especially the state, is not organized as a single religious truth, nor as rival organized religions seeking to dominate each other or seize the state. In relation to England or Britain, and I better say a little bit of why I say England or Britain, though I'm sure some of you will be aware of it. I mean, the English state was founded in, people say, 927, but was incorporated into the British state in 1701. And to this day, in contrast to Scotland and Wales, the other, as it were, component units, the other nations in the British state and Northern Ireland, it has no national assembly or government. Yet it does have a national church, which is the established church of the British state in the way that the Church of Scotland, the Presbyterian Church in Scotland, and the Church of Wales are not. Are you still with me? Okay, so that's why I say England or Britain, because the Church of England is the established church of the British state, but there are other churches that the other nations within Britain have which are not the established church. But England is not a state, because unlike the other nations, it does not have a representative assembly. Okay, so that's how we are. And I'd like to make 5 points about us as a secular polity. This isn't a comprehensive statement, of course not. And of course, you know, even though I'm supposed to kind of say a little bit about, you know, how the report looks from Britain and so on, if Professor Weinstock had invited someone else, that has said something different. So, you know, this is me speaking, not just any Briton coming here would say this. Okay, so my 5 points are these. The first one is that we have an unwritten constitution. By this I mean a constitution that is not codified into a single document and which in parts has the status of convention rather than law, let alone entrenched law. It is a constitution which is open to reinterpretation and adaptation without special assemblies and legislative majorities, or even legislative change, but sometimes through subtle changes in practice over time, which only much later, as the practices become set, can be seen to have constitutional consequences. A consequence of this is an acceptance of ambiguity and hybridity in favor of legalism or ideological coherence. And so the country can boast of being the birthplace of parliamentary government without dethroning a hereditary monarchy or abolishing an unelected upper chamber in its parliament. Moreover, radical constitutional change is informed by a spirit that a redistribution of powers should not be destabilizing and should be done without loss of dignity to the losers. Consider the aura of authority and prestige that continues to surround the monarchy and the House of Lords long after power has passed to the Prime Minister and the House of Commons. So that's my point one. You might say, well, that's not really about secularism, but it is, because obviously secularism is about constitutional, you know, processes, and so this is the kind of constitution that the other things I'm going to say about take place. My second point is religion and the public good. I think there's an assumption, perhaps only implicitly, that there is something legitimate about religion, or at least about some religions, so it ought to be accommodated rather than made invisible or privatized. For not only does it have an importance to some individuals and groups which should be respected, but that it is a public good or is able to contribute to the public good in the appropriate circumstances. So the presence of religion requires public acknowledgement, and the state should work to facilitate its contribution to the public good while being alert to its potential to harm the Commonwealth, including through benign neglect. The third point, a division of labour. The Church of England is the established or state church, with 26 of its bishops sitting in the House of Lords by right, and the head of state, the monarch, is also by right the supreme governor of the Church of England. Nevertheless, there's a fairly thoroughgoing division of labour between the temporal and the ecclesiastical parts of the constitution. The former used to have some say, but now have very little say on church matters, though the Prime Minister still has a final say on the church's choice of its leader, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And politicians rarely speak about even their own personal faith. The church should let politicians govern, but politicians should listen to the bishops when bishops address the public. It is widely regarded as appropriate for bishops, and indeed others with religious standing or conscience, to speak on matters of personal morality, such as issues around human reproduction, euthanasia, family, sexuality, and so on. Moreover, it is also widely regarded as appropriate for such religious figures to speak out on matters of political morality, such as issues of war and peace, nuclear weapons, poverty, third world debt, racism, the treatment of refugees, and so on. Religion must not have political power, but must be able to speak to power. So there is a mutual autonomy, but it's not absolute, and leaves some space for mutual influence. Fourth point, religious fraternalism. A feature of English society is the adversarial culture which characterizes its politics, law courts, industrial relations, interrogative journalism, public intellectuals, and even academia. Hence, it is quite striking that an aspect of modern England/Britain is a sense that different religions, meaning in particular people of different religions, should not be too critical or disdainful of each other, nor too self-promoting. They should treat each other with respect, certainly civility, and coexist in harmony. A source of this is a memory of religious strife, religion having caused the only civil war and regicide in English history, but it has come to have a positive side too. Britain has a culture of Christian ecumenicism, which more recently has developed into interfaith dialogue and cooperation, most of which is not on theological or metaphysical subtleties, but on civic and political matters, such as calming community tensions and campaigning for anti-discrimination legislation. This fostering of interfaith mutual awareness and harmony goes beyond religious leadership, or indeed people of faith, and is certainly not a private matter. Secular schools, often staffed by agnostics and atheists, who struggle to find staff willing to meet the statutory duty of providing daily Christian worship, enthusiastically display art and stories from Islam or Hinduism and celebrate Eid and Diwali as well as Christmas, as do some local governments. While there is considerable controversy around the niqab, that's the full face veil, and the burqa, the kind of head-to-toe loose coat, the presumption is that religious people, with whatever signs of faith they feel obliged to display, have to be welcomed into all the institutions of society and the state. The kippah, the Sikh turban, and the hijab have been incorporated into the uniforms of the armed services, the police forces, and the apparel of judges, amongst others. And you'll be aware that the Bouchard-Taylor report expressed some reservations about that in Quebec. My last point, the return of orthopraxis. The point that I've just made before can be taken further. Contemporary Britain, including the law, is permissive of a person who argues, my religion requires me to do X, especially if they can show that the action in question is mainly symbolic or dietary or about worship. For example, wear a turban rather than the refusal to do a military service. So, of course, if it becomes very important matters of policy and so on, that's different. But if it's just a matter of about personal conduct and a display of something and so on, British society, including the law, is very permissive. Yet it is noticeable that this seems to work more with minority faiths than when Christians make such appeals. For example, Sikhs cannot be asked to remove their turbans, but Christians cannot display a cross against their employer's wishes. This does not mean that the law or other institutions are biased against Christians. Rather, it seems to me, Christianity over the centuries has in Britain become a spiritual or ethical faith that does not require its adherents to display their identity or to rigidly follow a diet, and so on. So Christianity may once have been, and in other parts of the world may still be, a faith that did not only have an orthodoxy, but an orthopraxis, but that is not true today. Hence, it seems to me that the long historical trend in Britain away from behavioral religion to internalized faith is currently being checked and reversed, but not necessarily in the case of Christianity. So my concluding remarks. So Bouchard-Taylor rightly are concerned with the issue of the inclusion of ethno-religious minorities, especially Muslims. But compared to my rendering of the British experience, it is a subtractive view of inclusivity, while I think inclusivity should mainly be additive. We should not, for example, ask schools or other public institutions to stop celebrating Christmas because of the presence of Muslims or Hindus. Rather, we should extend the public celebrations to include Eid and Diwali. All the evidence suggests that this is what most minorities, especially Muslims, want. Hence, the challenge is not how to de-Christianize our respective states, but how to appropriately add the new faiths alongside the older ones. This, indeed, is what is happening, not just in Britain, but, though I may be contradicted here, but throughout Western Europe. What is interesting is that those most uncomfortable with this are not Christians or churches, but ideological secularists. Some people speak of a contemporary crisis of the secular state. I think that is a misnomer. What we are witnessing is a crisis of ideological secularism. Hence, at least in Western Europe, it is experienced much more by intellectuals, while politicians respond to the new challenges in a more temperate, pragmatic, and ultimately a more inclusive way.